Hi, friends. How are you doing today? I really hope that you guys are having the day that you deserve. My name's Carly Ramsey, and you are listening to the Serial Zodiac. I'm so excited that you're here and that you're wanting to listen to this episode. So, with that being said, I don't want to lollygag on too long, but I will be here for you guys every other Thursday to push you out new content. So, that being said, let's jump right into today's story. Thanks, guys. Hello, my little sleuths. How are you guys doing today? I'm so excited that you've decided to come back here for part two. Listen, pretty much the same morning as the first one. There's cannibalism again. Still, there is child murder. There's all kinds of things. Same warning from part one. I am reading another very disturbing letter in part two also, so be warned for that. That is a fair warning right there. But, you know, gotta jump right back in, so let's go. On July 14th, 1924, a 9-year-old kid named Francis vanished after playing catch with his friends in Staten Island. Can you imagine the panic that must have set in when he didn't make it back home? They organized a whole search party, and sadly, they found him the next day in a wooded area near his house. But here's the thing. He was found while he was hanging by a tree, and he had been strangled with his own suspenders. He was also found to have been sexually assaulted. Now, whenever Francis vanished, his parents went into action almost immediately. His dad was actually an active police officer at the time, and his parents sprung into action pretty quickly. So the search for Francis was very expedited. But what I found weird while doing my research on this was that they actually enlisted the help of the Boy Scouts, you know, Boy Scouts of America. They actually enlisted their help in searching for Francis. And I'm assuming that it was because they maybe just thought like he had ran away or something, because I would hope that they weren't like having these kids search for a body knowing that there would be a body. But I'm assuming that they thought Francis had just ran away and that they would kind of find him. But unfortunately, like I said, that was not the case. Francis was found, and unfortunately he was found by those Boy Scouts. Like I said before, strangled with his own suspenders. It was so brutal, in fact, that like the suspenders had kind of been buried in his skin. He had been like strangled so hard. But unfortunately, it gets even more gruesome after that. So the autopsy actually revealed that Francis had severe cuts on his legs and his stomach, and his left hamstring had actually been almost stripped of its flesh. The weirdest thing is the guy responsible, Albert, didn't own up to everything. He admitted to planning to mutilate Francis's body, but he took off when he heard someone coming. So Francis's friends told the cops that they had saw him taken by this elderly man with a gray mustache. Plus, a neighbor saw them heading into the woods together. Now, before you get upset because you're like, this could have been prevented, why didn't the neighbor say anything? This case takes place in a very, very different time. People nowadays are way more skeptical when they see things out of the ordinary. But for this neighbor, this wasn't really out of the ordinary because they were such like trusting people. So the neighbor would basically go on to say he saw them, but he thought it was just essentially like a grandpa and like his grandchild. And there actually is a, or was a park located on the other side of the woods that kids would frequently go through those woods to get to that park. So the neighbor would go on to kind of say, like, he just thought that the grandpa and the child were going to the park. He didn't realize that, I mean, like, that anything was wrong. And I mean, I'm very sure he probably beat himself up over that for quite a while because, like, it could have been prevented, but he didn't say anything. But once again, it was just a different time. And so, but Francis's mother, Annie McDonald, described seeing a strange guy earlier that day. She told reporters that he was shuffling down the street, mumbling to himself, and making these odd hand gestures. She noticed his thick gray hair and droopy gray mustache, and he just seemed to kind of be faded and gray all over. They actually started calling him the Gray Man after her description. But get this, Francis's murder went cold until another tragedy struck. Eyewitnesses, including Staten Island farmer Haynes Kill, pointed fingers at Albert, identifying him as the weird guy who was found hanging around Port Richmond the day Francis vanished. That led Richmond County District Attorney Thomas Walsh to go after Albert for the boy's murder. Initially, Albert denied any involvement. But then, in March of 1935, Albert finally came clean about Francis. He admitted to raping and murdering Francis. Now, once the public got wind of Albert's confession, the New York Daily Mirror labeled him as the most vicious child slayer in criminal history. But this wasn't even the end of the revelation. There was yet another murder that Albert committed, which soon came to light. And of course, we can't miss the disturbing trial that went down 3 months after his arrest. But before we can get to Albert's arrest, we need to backtrack 3 years after Francis McDonald's murder. Albert Fish actually moved towards the second murder that he would commit, and sadly, this brutal killing occurred only a year before Grace Buds. On February 11th, 1927, the lives of 3-year-old Billy Beaton and his 4-year-old companion, William Billy Gaffney, took a devastating turn in the city of Brooklyn. While innocently playing in the apartment hallways alongside Beaton's 12-year-old brother, both younger boys vanished without a trace. Beaton was later found alone on the roof of the apartments, but Gaffney's whereabouts remained a haunting mystery, his body never to be found. Now, I was kind of questioning, like, if the 12-year-old was supposed to be watching them, then how did they end up getting out of his sight? But, or more context behind Billy Beaton's 12-year-old brother, Billy Beaton's mom had I guess there was like a newborn in the mix, and Billy Beaton wasn't necessarily supposed to be watching. Billy Beaton's brother, his 12-year-old brother, wasn't necessarily supposed to be watching Billy and William, the Billies, the two Billies. He wasn't supposed to be watching them. He was supposed to be watching the baby. And it would actually be Billy Beaton's 12-year-old brother that was looking for them frantically when he noticed that they weren't there. I guess the baby started crying and the 12-year-old needed to go and like feed the baby. Once again, keep in mind, this is a different time. We are in 1927 right now. So people left their 12-year-olds home with their newborns and expected them to watch them. But he was taking care of the baby. He was playing with them on and off, but it was not his responsibility to be watching the Billies. So they're playing. He's watching the baby. They were in the hall, and then he comes back out to play with them again, and they're both just gone. Like I said, later, Billy Beaton was found alone on the roof of the apartment, but Billy Gaffney, his whereabouts remained a mystery. Now, initial suspicions pointed towards Peter Kinzwazowski. I hope I'm saying that correct. A known serial killer in the area. But another chilling revelation emerged, tying Albert Fish to the unsettling case. Joseph Meehan, a vigilant motorman on a Brooklyn trolley, unwittingly stumbled upon a piece of the puzzle when he recognized Albert's visage in the newspaper article. Recalling a disturbing encounter on February 11th, Meehan recounted spotting an elderly man, later identified as Albert, trying to soothe a distressed young boy on his trolley ride. The child, lacking proper clothes and wailing inconsolably for his mother, was forcibly taken on and off the trolley by the figure, aligning eerily with Beaton's account of the boogeyman who had taken Gaffney away. While mounting evidence and corroborating testimonies, authorities pieced together the narrative. They were able to link the description of the child to none other than young Gaffney. Going into Fish's whereabouts on that day, detectives from the Manhattan Missing Persons Bureau uncovered unsettling truths. He was employed as a house painter by a Brooklyn real estate firm in February of 1927, and his movements were traced to a location only a few miles from the scene of Gaffney's abduction. Determined to seek closure and answers, Gaffney's grieving mother, Elizabeth, went on a journey to Sing Sing Prison, accompanied by Detective King. Her heart heavy with grief and longing for closure, she confronted Albert in his bleak confines, almost begging him for information about her son's untimely death. But she was met with nothing but the silence of a remorseless predator. Albert callously ignored her attempts at solace. However, what Albert didn't say in person, he decided to say in written form. The truth about Billy Gaffney was revealed in a letter that he wrote to his attorney. The following is what he had to say. I brought him to the Raker Avenue dumps. There is a house that stands alone not far from where I took him. I took the G-boy there, stripped him naked, tied his hands and feet, and gagged him with a piece of dirty rag I picked out of the dump. Then I burned his clothes, threw his shoes in the dump, and then I walked back and took the trolley to 59th Street at 2 a.m. and walked home from there. Next day, about 2 p.m., I took tools, a good heavy cat of nine tails, homemade, short handle. Cut one of my belts in half, slit these halves into six strips, about 8 inches long. I whipped his bare behind till the blood ran from his legs. I cut off his ears, nose, slit his mouth from ear to ear, gouged his eyes He was dead then. I stuck the knife in his belly, held my mouth to his body, and drank his blood. I picked up 4 old potato sacks and gathered a pile of stones. Then I cut him up. I had a grip on me. I put his nose, ears, and a few slices of his belly in the grip. Then I cut him through the middle of his body, just below his belly button. Then through his legs about 2 inches below his behind. I put this in my grip with a lot of paper. I cut off the head, feet, arms, hands, and legs below the knee. These I put into sacks weighted with stones, tied the ends, and threw them into the pools of slimy water you see alongside the road going to North Beach. Water is about 3 to 4 feet deep. They sank at once. I came home with my meat. I had the front of his body I liked best. His monkey and peewees, and a nice little fat behind to roast in the oven and eat. I made a stew out of his ears, nose, pieces of his face, and belly. I put onions, carrots, turnips, celery, salt, and pepper. It was good. Then I split the cheeks of his behind open, cut off his monkey and peewees, and washed them first. I put strips of bacon on each cheek of his behind and put them in the oven. Then I picked 4 onions, and when the meat had roasted about 1.5 hours, I poured about 1 pint of water over it for gravy and put in the onions. At frequent intervals, I basted his behind with a wooden spoon so the meat would be nice and juicy. In about 2 hours, it was nice and brown, cooked through. I never ate any roast turkey that tasted half as good as his sweet, fat behind did. I ate every bit of meat in about 4 days. His little monkey was as sweet as a nut, but his peewees I could not chew. Threw them in the toilet. Now, as disturbing as that letter was, there's a bright side. Like I said earlier, that letter was written to his attorney. So if it was written to his attorney, that meant that Albert was now in custody. Albert's trial began on March 11th, 1935 in White Plains, New York. Judge Fredrickson P. Close presided over the proceedings, while formidable Westchester County Chief Assistant District Attorney Albert F. Gallagher led the prosecution. Spearheading Albert's defense was James Dempsey, a seasoned attorney and former prosecutor, as well as the erstwhile mayor of Peeksville, New York. Spanning 10 days, the trial unfolded as a riveting spectacle of law and psychology, with Albert invoking the plea of insanity, attributing his actions to divine commandments urging him to slay innocent children. As the courtroom brimmed with anticipation, a parade of psychiatrists took the stand, delving into the depths of Albert's psyche to unravel the reasons behind his aberrant desires and morbid obsessions. Among the myriad revelations laid bare during the trial was Albert's disturbing array of sexual fetishes, encompassing a grotesque spectrum of deviant practices, from sadism and masochism to fellatiation and voyeurism. Fish's proclivities defined comprehension, painting a portrait of psychological turmoil and depravity. His defense counsel, James Dempsey, delivered a poignant summation, portraying Albert as a perplexing anomaly in psychiatric and legal history. He was described as a man decided by a multitude of sexual abnormalities unmatched by any other. Central to the defense's strategy was the testimony of Frederick Wortham, a distinguished psychiatrist renowned for his expertise in child development. Over 2 days, Wortham illuminated the jury on Fish's intricate web of religious delusions, tracing their roots to his perverse interpretation of the biblical narrative of Abraham and Isaac. According to Wortham's testimony, Fish harbored a twisted belief that emanating Albert, the failed attempt at a sacrificial ritual, foiled by the unexpected presence of a passing car, only fueled Fish's insatiable bloodlust, culminating in the tragic fate of young Grace Budd. Despite her gender, Fish perceived Grace as a sustainable surrogate for his sacrificial ambitions, driven by his warped convictions and macabre fantasies. Wortham's account extended to Fish's grisly acts of cannibalism, which he grotesquely justified as a twisted form of communion, blurring the lines between religious fervor and deranged depravity. Dempsey's interrogation of Wortham culminated in a staggering revelation as he posed a sprawling 15,000-word inquiry into Fish's sordid existence, culminating in a damning assessment of his mental state. With conviction, Wortham delivered his verdict, proclaiming Fish's insanity as an inescapable reality. As the trial reached its climax, the juxtaposition of legal scrutiny and psychological inquiry offered a chilling glimpse into the mind of a remorseless predator. During the trial, Gallagher, the prosecutor, engaged in a rigorous cross-examination of Wortham, probing into Fish's understanding of morality. Wortham acknowledged that Fish had a distorted comprehension of right and wrong, tainted by his twisted interpretations of sin, redemption, and religious doctrine, which he categorized as insane knowledge. To bolster Wortham's assertions, the defense summoned two additional psychiatrists to testify, reinforcing the notion of Fish's mental instability. As the prosecution mounted its rebuttal, Mendes Gregory, former manager of Bulwine Hospital, took to the stand as the first of four witnesses. Gregory asserted that Fish exhibited abnormal behavior. He was nevertheless mentally sound. That while Fish exhibited abnormal behavior, he was nevertheless mentally sound. And when pressed by Dempsey on whether Fish's aberrant sexual proclivities indicated insanity, Gregory dismissed such notions, deeming them as socially acceptable deviances that are prevalent among a wide spectrum of people, including some of notable stature. The next witness, Perry Lichtenstein, a resident physician at the Tombs, faced scrutiny over his qualifications in psychiatry. Despite objections from Dempsey, Justice Close allowed his testimony, leaving the jury to weigh its significance. Perry contended that Fish's self-inflicted pain was not indicative of masochism, but rather served as a means to derive sexual gratification, further complicating the narrative of Fish's psychological state. Charles Lambert, another witness for the defense, sought to normalize Fish's deviant behavior, asserting that practices like porpophilia were not uncommon and did not necessarily denote psychosis. Lambert even suggested that religious cannibalism, while unconventional, could be perceived as a matter of personal preference rather than evidence of mental illness. James Vasicor echoed Lambert's sentiments, highlighting the defense's argument that Fishen's actions, however repugnant, did not signify. Oh my gosh, why is the word signify so hard for me to say? Did not signify a departure from societal norms. In a turn of events, Mary Nicholas's, Fish's 17-year-old stepdaughter, took to the stand as a defense witness, revealing the disturbing influence Fish had exerted within his own household. Mary recounted how Fish introduced her and her siblings to games influenced with elements of masochism and sexual molestation. Fish was a predator lurking beneath the facade of familial intimacy, and Mary was aware of that. Throughout the proceedings, the courtroom became a battleground of conflicting interpretations, with each testimony adding layers of complexity to Fish's enigmatic psyche. Despite unanimous agreement among the jurors regarding Fish's mental statement, they ultimately opted for his execution, believing it to be an appropriate course of action. Despite recognizing his insanity, they deemed him fit for punishment and delivered a verdict of guilt. Consequently, the judge sentenced Fish to death by electrocution. Fish's journey to his final moments began in March of 1935 when he entered prison, ending in his execution at Sing Sing on January 16th, 1936. Stepping into the chamber at 11:06 p.m., Fish met his death 3 minutes later, his life ending within the confines of the electric chair. His remains found their resting place in the Sing Sing Prison Cemetery. During his final moments, Fish reportedly collaborated with the executioner in positioning the electrodes on his body. His last words, "I don't even know why I'm here," spoke of confusion and maybe even resignation. Yet, the execution was not without controversy. Witnesses recounted that it took 2 jolts of electricity before Fish's life ceased, fueling speculation that the needles he had inserted into his body had sabotaged the apparatus. However, subsequent investigations refuted these claims, affirming that Fish's death followed the same procedure and time frame as other executions in the electric chair. Following Fish's execution, his lawyer, James Dempsey, revealed some very surprising things to reporters gathered for a post-execution briefing. He disclosed the existence of Fish's final statement, a collection of handwritten notes written by Fish in the hours leading up to his death. Despite the persistent inquiries from the press to divulge its contents, Dempsey adamantly refused, citing its profoundly obscene nature, describing it as, quote, one of the filthiest string of obscenities he had ever encountered. Dempsey chose to safeguard the document from public scrutiny, leaving the mysteries of Fish's final words shrouded in darkness to this day. Nobody knows if the note still exists. It could have very well been destroyed by Dempsey, but whatever Albert had to say in it will never be known to the world. Thank you again so, so much for joining me on Albert Fish Part 2. I know this was a very disturbing case. Probably one of the most disturbing cases that I've ever looked into, did research on. It's up there. I can promise you that. But I would just like to thank you for sticking around for part one and now part two. I really, really appreciate it so, so much. You don't even know. But thank you again. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel and subscribe. And also, I will link down below the link to my website, theserialzodiac.com, where you're able to sign up for my email list so you don't miss drops of new episodes ever. Every single episode drop will be sent directly into your inbox. So if that's something that you're interested in, I would highly suggest that you sign up. And also, it's May, so I don't know if you guys remember, but I am starting up with guests this month, and I am so, so excited for my first guest. He's my very, very best friend, and we're just going to have a great time talking about serial killers, as usual. But like I said, thank you so much again, guys, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day. Be safe, be cautious, and trust no one. Bye.